Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky in Florence.
I'm Jemima Kish in London.
Hey, and I'm Charles Arthur. I'm still in London.
Well, we're recording this show on Ada Lovelace Day, an international celebration of women in science and technology, named after the woman who wrote the very first computer programming language in 1842. We are continuing the celebration all week on The Guardian, where you can submit your own science and tech stories. So head to theguardian.com/witness to find out more. But back to this week's program. Over the next half an hour, we're looking at the global rebels who are battling for more control over the bodies that govern the internet to protect themselves from US snooping. We're looking at how the future transforms from exciting to mundane in just a moment. Supermarket Asda has announced 3D printing in its stores. And we're discovering the back doors and hardware that we have at home that lets anyone with the know-how play around in our networks. That's all coming up this week on Tech Weekly from The Guardian. As journalists from The Guardian and The Washington Post continue to pore over the information leaked by Edward Snowden earlier this year, countries from around the world, led by Brazil, are beginning to take steps to extract themselves from an internet that seems to be rooted through the USA. On Monday, Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff tweeted that her country is making steps to create a secure email system that will protect her citizens, visitors, and anyone who's communicating via the network with Americans from unwanted surveillance. Jemima, you've been covering this story on our live blog, covering everything about the NSA, along with Paul Owen. And I'm wondering, let's go back to basics on this story. Who is Dilma Rousseff?
She is the president of Brazil. Brazil has been quite outspoken in its desire to reclaim some control of the internet, or specifically the organisations by which the internet is sort of loosely governed. Most recently, she managed to sort of collar the head of ICANN, which is the body that looks after names for websites loosely, who was a man who was sort of vetted and approved by the US. And she's managed to persuade him sort of onto her team, as it were. So she's announced a summit in Brazil next year to kind of decide the future of the internet, which is very interesting. She cancelled a dinner with Obama last month in protest at the wake of the NSA revelations. And she is now leading a proposal for a bill in Brazil called the Marco Civil Bill, which is basically going to ensure much tighter cybersecurity for Brazil as a nation state.
And what does she want in general? What will be discussed at this summit?
Well, at the moment, there are several key things here. 90% of Latin America's internet traffic is routed through Miami, through a place called the Network Access Point.
That's sexy.
Very, very sexy, yeah. Rousseff is pushing for alternative networks, alternative cables, essentially, to connect South America to the rest of the world without having to go through a kind of US-controlled organization. She also wants... Internet governance gets very, very dull very quickly, but ICANN is one of a key group of controlling organizations, and the key controlling part of the internet is based on something called the IANA contract. This is all about the root servers for the internet, the authoritative root servers. There are only 13 in the world, and the one key root server at the heart of the IANA contract is controlled by VeriSign and the Department of Commerce in the US. It's the key part of the whole internet governance space, if you like, that the US will not relinquish, and that is going to be what Rousseff is encouraging all of the rest of the nation states that are involved in this push. She wants to encourage them to reclaim that authoritative web server. And theoretically, ICANN, without the permission of the US, could do that. They could say, okay, Geneva now has the authoritative root server, and make all of the other 12 root servers the copy of that. So very quickly it becomes very technical and very complicated, and it's deliberately so, I think, to kind of exclude a wider community of people, both, I suppose, politically and technologically. It's a very sort of elitist system and an elite group of people who understand and explain this stuff to a wider group.
I once heard a fascinating talk. It was at the Association of Internet Researchers annual meeting in, I think it was 2003 or even 2004, in which the keynote speaker described these root servers. This was, you know, lots of premonition going on here. But he said that there were 14 root servers, that one was secret, and in fact, this was the one that was controlled by the U.S. and all information had to go through the U.S. I don't know if either of you have ever heard about such a secret server. He seemed to be quite a reputable
speaker. It's
great.
I love it. The ghost server, the one whose existence you can never prove. It's sort of like, you know, all your conspiracy theories, you know, come home to roost.
And, well, given what's been sort of revealed in the last few months, frankly, nothing would be surprising.
That's true. It wouldn't surprise you. And that's the sort of the best thing with conspiracy theories and stuff. I mean, it could entirely be true. The question becomes one of what is your canonical root server, which is the one on which all the others rely. And to a large extent, the thing about the root servers is that they all peer to peer, and so changes that go on that appear on one get passed on to the others. But if there's a conflict, then in effect they sort of cede control to the one that's given the sort of description of the most important.
It's a symbolic authority.
But I guess the thing for Brazil and this whole question of, in effect, the balkanization of the internet is, would some country start saying, actually, you know what, we're not actually going to, you know, cede control to that server, to that root server. We're going to create our own intranet within Brazil, and we'll have pages which only we can find inside Brazil, and queries that come from outside Brazil trying to find this page on our web server or whatever won't be able to find it.
And this has been a bigger question about internet governance and also the openness of the internet in the past, is what used to be colloquially referred to as the internets. So having, as you say, Charles, multiple almost intranets within countries, within organizations, it's something that happens more frequently. But this and also when people talk about these intranets, they also discuss the language that people are using to communicate. But this would actually be, you know, what is proposing this kind of splinterization, this balkanization of the internet. What effects, Jemima, would that have on how the internet is governed and, in fact, how the internet operates?
God, if I knew that, I'd probably be consulting somewhere and being paid a lot. There are multiple aspects to this. I think the important thing to say is that until there is certainly a little bit more transparency by the US government over the extent and the controls that are on its surveillance systems, there isn't going to be faith internationally to have a more centralized system. The US led the push at the World Telecommunications Treaty Summit in November to not have a more centralized, standardized internet that is effectively overlaid onto the telecommunications network worldwide, sort of arguing that it's a separate network, and actually it's not. So, you know, look at the Petrobras economic spying. And this is the thing that's really got the backup of Brazil. It's one of its biggest companies. It's one of the 30 biggest companies in the world, and it's state-owned. And obviously, they have very sensitive economic information. The NSA, Rousseff certainly feels, has been way outside of its bounds doing effectively economic spying on one of its biggest companies. So until there is generally some kind of understanding over the extent of this kind of surveillance, we will just see more and more attempts by countries to fracture off a piece of the internet over which they have more control and oversight. And that is not necessarily a very good thing, because in countries like India, for example, where even recently the internet freedom ratings rated India the worst place in the world. So now we're seeing government employees not being allowed to use Gmail in India because they don't want the NSA having a kind of overview of what they're talking about. But is the Indian government any more capable of providing, you know, security and privacy for its citizens?
I would say that I just sort of point to actually something from economics. Paul Krugman, who a lot of people know as the New York Times sort of blogger and economic commentator, he actually got his Nobel Prize for the study he did about how even countries which make the same stuff have trade between each other, because it turns out that that's actually an efficient way to do things, that if you have trade between each other, then both economies benefit. And I think that the balkanization of the internet, that if countries were to sort of say, well, you know, we're going to have our own intranet, which you can't find from outside, I think that would rather be like cutting your trade off. It's an information trade rather than a goods trade, but it would have the same negative effect. I think that actually the great thing with the internet is it does open up countries to all sorts of new information, and it has a really beneficial effect. And I think the balkanization idea is sort of sounds great if you want to sort of poke the US in the eye for a bit, but in the longer term, actually, it's not going to make that much difference in terms of spying, and it's not going to be at all beneficial in terms of economy.
Jemima, what support does Rousseff have at the moment? You mentioned that she's managed to get the head of ICANN on side.
It's not quite as simple as having one group of people on her side. I mean, there are, Russia and China particularly would love to see control of the internet taken away from the US. I say that in the loosest terms, because the US would argue that, you know, it's a multi-stakeholder approach and that they don't have control. But, you know, it stems from lots of organisations that started in the US, and it's a Western kind of approach. So Russia and China want to have a little bit more oversight. But then countries like Germany have also announced that they're going to be doing their own secure email system. So there are multiple pulls in multiple directions for multiple reasons.
You can read the latest on the NSA leaks at theguardian.com/world/NSA. Now, it's been an interesting week for internet security. A curious computer tinkerer reverse-engineered a D-Link brand Wi-Fi base station and discovered that within the code, there was a way for anyone to gain access to the router's web-based control panel without a password. It was also confirmed that it's possible to run code via this back door. Charles, what does this mean for me as the owner of a D-Link brand router?
It means that you should turn off remote access for administrators, which probably should be off already, but you might want to be absolutely certain on that. You should go to the settings, and you should change the default password for the router if you haven't already. Again, most people don't change defaults, which is a little bit sad. I suppose you could just unplug it from the internet. D-Link says that it will have a fix for the affected routers, which doesn't seem to be all of their routers, but it certainly seems to be quite a few of them, because they make a lot, by the end of this month. But it's an interesting sort of commentary on the way that interested tinkerers can find out very interesting and rather revealing things by playing around with freely available source code.
And it certainly also means that someone is shipping Wi-Fi routers with security backdoors in them. And obviously, you know, I'm imagining that this isn't just D-Link. There was also some rumor on the site where this tinkerer revealed what he had done, that this may affect the owner of Virgin Media's home hubs. So it isn't just this particular company. Have we seen this kind of thing before? How rife is this? How often does this happen?
Well, a lot of routers that are sold for consumer use, and especially ones that are provided by internet service providers for home use, do tend to have remote administrative access, because for a lot of people who are not particularly tech savvy, when the router goes wrong, all they can say is, something's wrong with my router. What tends to happen then is you get someone on the maintenance side who is able to log in remotely and say, oh, okay, well, this is happening, you've not done that, and so on. Or they can update the firmware, for example, if they need to fix a security hole, not including sort of remote access ones. So there is a sort of legitimate use. You can argue that there's actually a useful, beneficial use to having these sorts of backdoors. The problem comes when they're easily found and when they're standard on routers which are not sold as part of an ISP package.
What kinds of things could happen to me, though, if somebody accessed this backdoor?
Well,
read John Norton's piece in The Observer last week. It's all very apocalyptic.
Yeah, it certainly is. And actually, that's a nice time, Jemima, to highlight last week's Observer Tech Monthly, in which John wrote exactly about this.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, Charles, as you were saying.
That's okay. Well, yeah, they can. Being able to look at your network is one of the things you don't really want them to be able to do. They can, you know, perhaps drop malware onto your machines. They can see what devices you have running. They can, they could divert what you're doing. They can set up all sorts of redirects for websites without you knowing about it. So basically, it's a thing you don't want to happen.
Now, hardware backdoors aren't unusual. Last year, Chinese companies Huawei and ZTE, we covered actually the story. They were effectively banned from selling their network equipment on U.S. soil in case the systems had backdoors that could be accessed by Chinese Secret Service. I don't suppose, Charles, we know if the NSA accessed any information in their surveillance programs via backdoors, do we?
We don't know that directly. The question of quite what the NSA did access and didn't access and quite how it accesses it is one which is sort of it's generally not been revealed. I mean, the way that the Guardian, the New York Times, the Washington Post and ProPublica have been dealing with the Snowden disclosures, for example, has been very much not to reveal operational detail, as in how do they do it, but more the general picture, the what do they do. So, in describing things like the PRISM program, the Guardian, for example, simply described the fact that the NSA claimed to have what it called direct access to data from Google, from Yahoo, from Apple, and so on, but not how precisely it did it. And the details about how maybe it did it came out subsequently from companies such as Google, which suggested that it had a secure FTP transfer.
Huawei. They announced this week as part of George Osborne's little flit over to China that they're going to be opening a £200 million R&D centre in the UK. So we might be about to find out.
And and recently we discovered that some of the UK's own government systems operate on Huawei's telecoms and network infrastructures, didn't we?
Yes. It's intriguing. I've heard suggestions that one of the reasons why the US is very much against having Huawei provide any of its network backbones is because they can't be certain that they can tap into it. That is, the NSA and sort of similar federal agencies couldn't be certain that they could tap into it in the way that they can with US-built ones. So possibly the worry isn't so much about whether there would be Chinese backdoors or Chinese access into the network backbone, more that there would be sort of a block on US access. So it's not necessarily that Huawei is any more or less safe, but just that the foreknowledge doesn't exist necessarily to be able to get into the systems.
Conspiracy theories are rife there. Let's postulate here. If there were backdoors that were put into systems that that the US government was able to access, the question, of course, is who would put them in there? In the same way that if there are backdoors into Huawei, people are supposing that the Chinese Secret Service would be putting those backdoors in. But ultimately, the backdoors, are they developers who accidentally forget to clean up their code? What is the most likely operational sequence?
It's all sorts of things. Sometimes it's developers who forget to clean up, and so a default gets left in, or it's left in as a backup in case you need to get access to it. Or, and this is something which I've heard from sources I find reliable, sometimes some of these backdoors are intentionally put in at the urging of people who can't be named.
Intriguingly vague.
Sometimes they're there because they're just badly coded, and actually, it's possible to hack these things in ways that people hadn't thought of. So it spans the gamut, really, intentionally there with good intentions, intentionally there with mixed intentions, and unintentionally there.
The full scale, from pesky to evil.
Yes.
Yeah. Voldemort is clearly involved.
Yeah.
He clearly cannot be named. You can read up more on this topic and some of the other backdoors that we've uncovered. Charles, you reported last year on the Boeing 787 Dreamliner's back door that could allow the aircraft to be taken over via the internet. And you can find out all about that at theguardian.com/technology. If there's one technology that screams the future, it's the 3D printer. Promising a post-industrial, personalizable supply chain, the stories say that if we want something in the future, we'll be able to print it, anything at all. It's fantastical, it's magical, and now it's high street supermarket Asda. Suddenly it doesn't feel so magical after all. Yes, Asda has announced that they will be trialing a 3D printing service in their York store, allowing customers to get anything larger than a shoebox printed in ceramic for 40 British pounds. Jemima, now that the future's here, how do you feel about it?
Oh, God. Well, it's obviously good for sort of public understanding and acceptance of 3D printing. So this is very much a sort of an introductory phase. And if it's in Asda, then you can't get much more mainstream than that. Brilliant. It's not actually that useful, though, is it, to have a 3D ceramic thing? I mean,
I can honestly, I'm just thinking of the office parties.
Yeah. I don't know. It is good. It's a good thing. But I'm just sort of hankering now for 3D printing to be useful, I suppose.
Jemima brings up an interesting point. At the moment, it's a really interesting gimmick, and I can imagine that this is going to stuff the stockings of many a family at Christmas with, you know,
can
little
you?
Busts of
wow. Well, okay, I can't, but go on.
Well, with little 3D printed versions of yourself.
Oh, okay.
But it does need to make that transition, as Jemima's saying, from you know, the fantastical to the useful. And this is a process that seems to be kind of lost. The romance seems to get lost when an amazing technology of the future becomes totally mundane. So, you know, I'm thinking about the mobile phone or touch screen, even Segways and possibly jetpacks in the future. But what is lost? Do we lose the kind of the dream, the vision of the future when suddenly we can get our faces 3D printed for Auntie in Asda?
So let me tell you a little story. In the first series of Star Trek, the very, very first one with William Shatner and stuff, they were all, you know, the Captain's Bridge and all that stuff. It was a set, obviously. And they used to treat all the things on the set really gently. So they used to press the buttons, like William Shatner would press the buttons on the captain's chair very gently because he was afraid, like, oh, we're in a spaceship and it might break. By the second series, they'd realized that actually these people lived in this thing all the time and that they wouldn't treat it like that. So if you see the later episodes of Star Trek original series, Shatner is banging the buttons on the chair and whacking it. He's, you know, he's really living in it. And that's the sort of difference, is that when the future hasn't arrived, when you're thinking, it'd be great, wouldn't it, if you had a phone that you could just take anywhere and you could just make a call and it wouldn't be tied to the wall, which is how it used to be sort of 30 years ago. You know, that's the romance. And when people first got mobile phones, they treated them with a sort of reverence. Now people drop phones, you know, they fall down, they sit on them, all that sort of stuff. The aspiration has gone out of it because it's become completely quotidien. But the thing is that, you know, you're living in that, you know, the dreams go away, but the reality comes and you realize that actually you've got other things that you want to dream about. So, you know, with 3D printers, very much the same sort of thing. You know, people are saying, oh my God, I could recreate that train. I could get a little, you know, version of myself in plastic. Totally true, you could, but I'm not sure it's going to enhance your life. And the life-enhancing things of 3D printers, I suspect, are actually going to be more routine, but equally more useful, like sort of getting a new screw printed for the washing machine, because, you know, getting one ordered from the factory is such a faff.
It's when it comes in new materials as well, because I have two small children at home and a house full of plastic kiddie crap. And frankly, I don't need any more plastic kiddie crap or plastic any crap in my house. So when 3D printers can print in multiple different textiles and materials, then we'll start seeing something a little bit more useful.
I think when we can feed the kiddie crap into the 3D printer to make useful stuff.
That's already a thing. It's called I want to say filibot, but it's not filibot. But you put plastic that you need to recycle into a machine. It grinds it up and makes it into a sort of plastic powder that you can then feed into your 3D printer.
Awesome. I've got years worth of it.
I think it
might
be filibot.
Can you imagine, though, you'd go from like all of these lovely, shiny, bright primary colors into, you know, it's like when you get lots of Play-Doh and you manage to smush it all together and it just turns into that kind of brown.
Exactly.
Yeah, brown and gray.
It is filibot. It's on Kickstarter. There you go. F-I-L-A-B-O-T. Yeah. Mm.
Very good idea. How do you feel about the idea of being able to print representations of ourselves or to document ourselves from the kind of the flat two-dimensional to something that's much more sculptural? Will that change how we perceive the past and how we perceive ourselves?
I don't think it will change. I think, as Charles said, day to day, we sort of assume these technologies and these forms. It doesn't take long for something to become normal. And there is a novelty at the moment to seeing yourself in 3D miniature, very accurate form. But we'll soon get very... we'll soon become accustomed to that. I think, sort of artistically speaking, this refers back to Walter Benjamin, who wrote a very interesting essay called The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. And this was at the time when photography was just taking hold and art had a bit of a crisis. And was kind of saying, well, hang on, we're supposed to sort of represent the world. And art had to maybe not reinvent itself, but it had to rethink its purpose. And I think that purpose, of course, is to challenge us and to make us think, not to just literally represent the world, either in 3D or 2D form. So this will have interesting repercussions for the art world, I think.
And Charles, in terms of how we document our lives, at the moment we've got, we've got pictures and frames that are on the mantelpiece. Will we, in the future, have little 3D representations? And then I can only imagine that we will become closer to Harry Potter because they might even move around eventually.
Tricky. I would go with no on this one. I think that photos have a sort of a value. Printing out a photo, as one tends to do now, you know, very, very occasionally, still has a value just because it's much easier to put against a wall. You know, 3D.
I like my version of the future better, frankly.
Yeah.
Little dancing people. Get a 3D printed model of my grandmother doing the kick line, the conga or something across my mantelpiece if I had one. I think that would be great.
Well, I've been trying out an app called Scene, S-E-E-N-E, which gives you a sort of, lets you take a sort of 3D photo on your phone. And I think that's quite fun. That actually is a bit Harry Potter, in as much as you can sort of, you know, look around the object.
That must be
you
similar.
Get to elf yourself at any time of
it's
year.
That maybe. Similar technology to that Rolling Stones video a few years back that at the time was quite sort of groundbreaking, wasn't it? I forget the actual song, but it was Jagger in 3D.
Jagger in 3D. Well, you can find out more about 3D printing at theguardian.com/technology. Bing, Microsoft's search engine. It isn't Google, we all know that, but does it actually want to be? According to Dave Coplin, the head of Search UK for Bing at Microsoft, no, they don't. They know that they're fighting a losing battle, but they're not going to go without that fight. So although Bing is almost a technological parity with its rival, they're practically invisible on the public stage. Charles, does that mean that the results that you get are any worse than what you get from Google?
No, I would say that the thing about search results, certainly from the big search engines, is that they're pretty much a commodity. The search that you do for 80%, 90% of things will turn up pretty much the same set of 10 blue links, certainly on the desktop. So actually, search is such a commodity that it's become completely background, I would say.
And actually, you describe that in this interview. You talk about it almost as if it's like running water. So why was it that Dave was in town then? Is he trying to drum up publicity for Bing, even though he admits that that might just be losing the battle?
So they're trying to do a few things. They're trying to point out that Bing can stretch across all the Microsoft platforms. So as well, obviously, as being on Windows, it's also on Windows Phone. but also it's on the Xbox, and they're trying to make it smarter than just something which provides 10 blue links. And that was really what Dave Coplin was talking about.
And how do they plan to keep their heads above the water? How will they integrate all of this?
Well, this is the interesting question, because Bing has been losing money in a big way for quite a long time, for something like 7 years off the top of my head. And the question is, you know, if you have a new chief executive comes in, will they wonder about the amount of money that's seeping under the door? So the thing with Bing is pointing out that not only is it a commodity, but it also provides something else, which is a flexible underpinning for all of the Microsoft services. So I put to Dave Coplin, who is head of search for Microsoft in the UK, the obvious question: why does Bing need a UK search executive?
Really, my job is all about helping people understand just what is Microsoft doing with search. And so what's our philosophy behind search? Where are we going? What does the future look like for us? Because the crucial thing about what Microsoft's approach for search is doing is we're not trying to out-Google Google. And this is not just about answering questions. It's actually, we have this thing where search is almost like the user interface for the web, because it's the place you start your journey. We see it as a service that stitches together a bunch of disparate pieces and brings them back to the consumer. And when you're starting to see that across all of our products. And that's not something that is that intuitive. If you're used to 15 years of, you know, 10 blue links, you don't really think about search in that context, which is why they need me around to sort of help tell that story and help people understand how we're different in our approach.
So, I mean, in a sense, search is the start button for the web. Yeah, it has rather the same sort of function. That you go and you hit the search and you get some results, and then you go and do something with it.
Yeah, and then we sort of go a step further. So we're starting to think of Bing particularly as the golden thread across our, not just our platform, but I'll talk about our platform to start with. So let me give you an example. It's a bit of a confession. I've got 3 Xboxes at home. Don't start. And an Xbox One on pre-order I haven't quite told the wife about yet, which we'll get to. I've got an Xbox in my kitchen because I do all the cooking at home. And I'll go home tonight, I'll spark up the Xbox, and while I'm starting to cook tea, I'll just go Xbox, Bing the Clash. And Xbox then uses Bing to curate an experience, uses my music subscription to curate a playlist of music, and there I am listening to the Clash. Fantastic. Just think about that. That's a search engine has done that. Didn't answer a question. It curated an experience for me. Similar thing with Bing Translator. So my son's got a nut allergy. We were in Spain last year on holiday, and I speak 2 words of Spanish, you know, beer and scorchio, as every good Englishman does. And I could stand in a supermarket and look at the ingredients of a packet of biscuits, and I could use Bing to translate the words and find out whether they've got any nuts in. Again, that's a search engine doing that. And so you're seeing all of these little nuggets where Bing is curating his experiences. Windows, you know, the way that you get news feeds, weather, travel, health and lifestyle. We have access to a whole bunch of, let's call them big data services, in order to power the index. Well, we're starting to surface those in other areas of the product. So the Windows 8.1 modern interface apps. Again, search engine, well, that's really weird. So that's the bit that we're trying to get people to understand. So yes, it is the start button, but it's also underneath the hood. It's the engine that's powering a lot of these other experiences on other elements of our platform. And the bit where it's important to sort of note, it's not just about our platform, is that those experiences extend into iOS and to Android as well. So we're, you know, looking out further into integration, whether it's through the iPhone app or whether it's through just simply the browser experience that you get.
So let's ask the hard question, because being the online services part of Microsoft has lost colossal amounts of money for a very long time. Microsoft is going to have a new chief executive within the next 10 months, I think it is now. What if they come in and there is shareholder pressure, and whoever the person is looks at the numbers and says, you know what, this online services business, they are losing money hand over fist, and there's no sign of them ever making money. Why don't we just shut it down?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Charles. And it's something that you see goes in a cycle from time to time. It's like, are we going to sell Bing? And for me, based on the philosophy of what we're trying to deliver, you can't deliver any of the experiences on Xbox, on Windows Phone, unless you have the index, unless you have search.
Does it have to be the Bing index underneath it? Or could you buy in from Google or, I don't know, from someone else?
Knowing the amount of energy and work that goes into getting the index right and localized and supporting the other products, I think you have to own it. I think we have to own it. It has to be ours in order to do that. And not just to integrate into our platform, but also to differentiate that service as well, to be able to do more with it. So I can't subscribe to the thought that says that being, you know, if all we were doing was trying to out-Google Google and it was about 10 blue links and whether our 10 blue links are better than their 10 blue links, then I could buy an element of your argument and, you know, it might be a possibility. But you just have to look at, you know, any of the recent products, devices, services, whatever they might be, and you see that Bing's at the heart of them, and you can't take that away.
So the argument is it's a bit like Apple and Maps then, where Apple said we have to own Maps. It's a sunk cost and it's an ongoing cost, but we just have to. It's a price of being at the table. We have to own our own Maps, not Google. You're saying that you have to, in effect, own search in order to be able to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. But then I guess the slight twist in what you're saying is that over time, it becomes profitable. So like any, you know, good research and development project, you've got this, you know, years of getting it right and figuring it out and losing money and just understanding how it works and bringing it to life. And then you get success if you're lucky.
And then 10 years so far.
Well, it has been 10 years. But I think, and maybe it's because I'm, you know, work for Microsoft, but I think very differently about what we're doing with Bing today to where we started with LiveSearch. You know, it's a fundamentally different place. And I think, you know, it's a bit back to that online services vision. And what I think you're seeing in Microsoft today is a much more connected left to right. You know, Chilo is just wonderful in terms of that vision. He's really thoughtful about what is this
going to do? He's the head of Microsoft.
I'm sorry, yeah. Yes. So, well, he's the head of online services now, right, in the recent reorg. And that's really important because the thing that it's within him is this whole thing about we have to basically blur the boundary between the analog and digital worlds. We need to make sure that wherever you are, whatever you're doing, you can reach in to the best of the digital world has to offer to change, to improve your physical, your real world experience. And so he's got this left to right view. He's not thinking in the domain of search and he's not thinking about these silos of services. He's thinking about service layers. And that's the magic, I think, for me, for what we're doing. You start to see it play out and you start to see it pay off in terms. And I think, you know, profitability comes through that success when people wake up and see. And it's part of the reason why we're here. You know, in a market like the UK, we're 5% market share, which is frustrating given where we think the product's at and where we know the product's at based on the research that we've seen. But we've got this mindset, this mentality, this habit that people have about Google. And don't get me wrong, I think Google do a great job. I think they have a brilliant product. The really important thing for us to sort of get across here and for people to understand is that we're on a different trajectory. And we want people to make a choice about where they want to be rather than just sleepwalking into a choice. And so we can talk about that in a bit more detail, but that's kind of the broad picture.
And what about the job of the chief envisioning officer? What does that involve?
Well, first of all, understand it's a comedy job title. We're quite upfront about that. One of the things, Charles, you'll know well, is that what Microsoft does really well is we're great at talking about our technology. We talk about our products. But there's a part of the story that we talk about less, and I think it's really important, which is the human beings that use the technology and products. And part of my challenge today is I look around, and I've got far too long in the IT industry, 20-odd years, and I grew up on a really unhealthy dose of Star Trek on comic books when I was a kid, and I was determined that, you know, technology is a force for good in society. It enables you to do brilliant things. And then you do 20 years in IT and you just think, oh my God, you know, where did we go wrong? And you see people implementing new technology to replicate old analog processes rather than to say, well, could we do things differently? So we invented this role because this is a job basically that thinks about the future of humanity. So we decided it needed a job title with a certain level of pomposity. And also, you know, when I was a kid, I said to my mum, I said, Mum, one day when I grow up, I'm going to be CEO at Microsoft. You just watch me. And as it turns out, you know, this is probably the only way I'm going to pull that
off. Chief
Visiting
Officer, yes.
So really, it's a lovely conversation because it's all about the human beings and it's not about pushing product or anything, but it's trying to open people's eyes to the potential of technology rather than just constraining them down to what they've always done.
Does that also involve saying, talking about how people actually use technology rather than how you'd like them to use the technology?
Yeah, we try to be quite pragmatic about it. And you know, we understand that this is not some utopian science fiction dream that we can all do this stuff and we're all going to have hoverboards and all that sort of stuff. But it's kind of like opening people's eyes to what becomes possible, then looking very much about where they are today and then figuring out how you can get them to the place that you want them to be. And the comedy for me as a guy from a technology company is that this is is all about the human beings. You know, this is more maybe for the enterprise customers, the technology that people use at work. But if you're not helping people to aspire to do great things, they're just going to use the technology in the same way that they've always used it, which actually belittles the potential of what not just Microsoft is doing, but all of us in the IT industry. So it really is about opening people's eyes to the fact that you could do things differently, and then figuring out how do you make the cultural change possible? How do you help the organization or the individual, if it's our consumer behavior, how do you make the cultural change that then enables them to get the benefit from what's on offer from the technology?
Wasn't one of the big changes in how people use technology actually the one when PCs particularly became really widespread among consumers, and they then started being able to use their own apps, and they realized that actually the things they were using at work were terrible.
Yes.
And they said, boy, the simplicity of, I don't know, the MySpaces, the Facebooks, and the procedures. Yeah. And Google especially. I mean, you know, Google was the absolute example of how terrible your enterprise, whatever enterprise app you might have been using was, because Google was fantastically simple.
Yeah.
And isn't that one of the sort of the things that's overthrown the enterprise app has actually just been the consumer?
Yeah, well, I'm going to sound a bit like the bloke from Remington now, because I believe that so much that I bet my career on it. So I was an enterprise IT guy until 4 years ago, and I'd realized the power of consumerization, how important that was to not just what we were doing at Microsoft, but again, from a position of some technology lovey who wants everybody to get the most out of technology. You realize that unless you understand the consumer world, you're never going to get that. And I've got all this experience in enterprise IT, doing architecture and all that sort of stuff. No experience of consumer IT. So I got an opportunity to work with Bing. And the magic thing about search is, again, back to the way we started this conversation, is it spans everything. It's not like it's a niche area like the browser or even like the games console. It touches everything. And so it opens up this debate. So I now feel I've got this really good understanding of what it means to be a consumer. And we see this bizarre thing that happens today. I mean, I've spent most of my career chasing people down corridors like some bizarre, freakish stalker, trying to get them to care about technology. And today, it's the other way around. They're chasing me down the corridor because they've had such a rich experience in their personal lives that they can't get to in their professional lives. And they're like, come on, IT guy, what are you going to do for me? How are you going to make this easy? And whether it's, you know, if you look at where Google search was, let's say, I don't know, 8 years ago versus enterprise search. I mean, it was just 8 years ago in enterprise search, we were still trying to get the business to conform to taxonomies, you know, to agree on file naming conventions and all that sort of stupidity. Whereas Google, you know, it's an unstructured approach and it just works. You make order out of chaos. Mm. So I think we get that. And I think the journey that we're on now, and you'll see actually the interesting thing with Bing is you'll see Bing become more and more prominent in the enterprise space within Microsoft as well. You already see it in little snippets today. So for example, you're typing in Word and you want to look up that word. Well, it uses Bing to bring the dictionary. And again, more and more you'll see Bing use its big data services. I hate that cliche, I'm sorry. It's data services to pull in information that will change the context of what you're doing or give you more insight. And so you see this blurring between enterprise and consumer, which I just think is fundamental. I don't want to be talking about IT in 10 years from now. You know, I don't want my son to go into a job in IT. I want my son to go and do a job, whatever he wants to do, and be really empowered to use technology to make a difference. That's what I think we should be aiming for.
But you've come in because you've got a particular challenge as well that you want to explain to us.
Yeah, so you know, we started out from the position that we just set out, Charles, which is about, you know, we're on a different journey with search, but we live in a world in the UK in particular where Google's just what you do. It's the verb. You know, you talk to anybody and it's just, well, why would I use anything else? So we were frustrated by this because obviously we're quite confident with what we've done at Bing and where we are. And so we did some research. And we did some research in June and we took 1,000 people and we gave them 10 queries. And the queries had come from Google Zeitgeist from 2012. And we found some really incredible results. And understand this is a really subtle message, but 39% of the 1,000 people chose Bing over Google in those 10 search results. 32% chose Google over Bing. 29% didn't care, couldn't tell the difference. And what was really important for us is, yeah, and again, it's sort of quite subtle in the sense, we're not saying we're better than Google. We're saying we're different to Google. We're going in a different direction. And we're at a place where we think at least the engines are at parity, but we're in a world where nobody even thinks of us. You know, in fact, they ridicule us. You know, we get all sorts of interesting quotes over Twitter that, you know, you can imagine. And so we thought, well, we have to fix that, because the point about search is that people should make an active choice, and they should really understand. And I get that search is a utility. It's not like the most important choice you're going to make in your day.
I mean, yes, but I was going to say, it is a bit of a commodity thing, isn't it? It's a bit like sort of, well, I choose my water supplier.
Exactly.
But and the electricity supply.
And in our results, if you think about it, the people I'm most interested in is the 29% who weren't really that bothered, because they're the people who sleepwalk every day mm-hmm. into their provider. And I just think search is too important a service, because it provides, you know, that has the potential to provide all of these things, that they really need to think about that. And we really want people to wake up to the fact there's a choice. We want to go to the Google fanboys and girls as well. And you know, I expect hilarity to ensue as they will try the test. We've got a test where you can go and do this yourself. It's a bingiton.com. And you go there and you'll be presented with a screen. You'll be asked for 5 queries, and it'll tell you, basically it shows you a left pane and a right pane, stripped of all of the branding. You can figure out, you know, which is the answer that you like, and then it summarizes you chose Bing over Google or Google over Bing, whatever it might be. So I'm expecting hilarity to ensue when the Google fanboys and girls choose Google and all that sort of stuff. But the point is about waking people up to that choice, seeing that actually we're not in the place that you think we are. We're not 5% market share because we're 5% as good as Google. We're there actually because we're fighting this habit, we're fighting this perception. And so it's really just to raise awareness for where we are and what we're doing.
So do you think that there would be a possibility, as Bing and search underpins more and more Microsoft services? I mean, it's already on Windows Phone. It's sort of built into Windows 8 and 8.1. As you said, it could be part of Word. Does there come a point when you say, hey, you know, Bing the search engine, no adverts at all. We don't actually need it.
That's a really, really interesting question. And let me tell you, that's going around a lot internally and has always done, right? Because we were never an advertising company in terms of our products were used as advertising vehicles. They are today, and we're very proud of some of the innovation we have about the advertising approach and what we offer our advertisers that you can't necessarily get through Google, again, because of the breadth. But there is this... I don't know. There's the evolution I think we have to have about the revenue for these services and where that comes from and the reality. And so it's look at the similar sort of debate that's going on in your industry about paywalls. And people are still trying to figure out where we're at and what could we do and what's possible. And then ultimately we live in a world of free or freemium. And it's hard, even if you've got the right model, to break through that, because people don't always value the service that you're providing. I mean, there's the conversation that you and I had about journalism is, you know, I can get my news from Twitter, but I can't get the same level of quality of reporting or insight, you know, that I would get from a proper journalist or from buying a newspaper. And that's a hard conversation to have. So I think as we go through, I think society is going to evolve in understanding what the role of advertising is. I think advertising as it's done today digitally as a technology guy, I just think is awful in the sense that, you know, look what's happening on mobile. We've taken what we've done on display, and now we just do it on a smaller ad on your screen. And it's like, no. And I think we could be more intelligent. And I get that there are privacy issues around this. But if I knew more about you, or even if maybe you told me more about yourself, I could serve you better ads that then deliver you value at the content. And that's a place that I want to go as a technologist. So I think there is a massive role for advertising, but it's trying to figure out the balance of where that goes. I think, you know, overall in this is understanding this is an ecosystem game now. And it is about who's got the deepest and broadest ecosystem that delivers the kind of services. And within that, one of the bits that I'm quite proud of from a Microsoft perspective is we don't stop at our own boundary. It's not about that kind of a walled garden. That's why you can have a great experience. So the other night I was playing Forza 5 on my Xbox, which is a great game. But I've got an iPad on my coffee table, and the iPad is my sat-nav screen for the car I'm driving. And as I change the thing on the iPad, it's changing my game experience. And I just think, there aren't many companies in the tech industry that would develop a solution that brings to life a competitor's platform. And I get that we do it because it then becomes a bridgehead into our platform and all that sort of stuff, but it's pretty cool. And I think that's why Bing's important, because it is. It's one of those things that spreads across and it goes beyond into iOS and Android as well. And that makes me proud, because we're delivering that service. We're trying to take people on that different journey.
That was Dave Coplin from Microsoft. That's all we have time for this week, but if you want more technology news, keep your eyes peeled to The Guardian for the latest on the Google and Facebook terms of service and privacy policy changes. The latest on Argos's My Tablet, the high street chain's £99 competitor to the iPad and Tesco's Huddle, and the leaks about Steve Wozniak's keynote at next week's Apps World, where he's expected to announce Apple's new iOS and their new tablet. Thanks to Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur, as always. And next week, we'll hear from Intel about their foray into the maker scene. Their Galileo chipset is Arduino compatible, and this is getting the world of education very excited indeed. The producer of Tech Weekly is Jason Phipps. I'm Alex Krotowski. See you next week.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.